Hello and welcome to another edition of the Cultural Colchester podcast. My name is Tim Young and I've got another special guest with me today. We did have Steve Mannix from the Mercury Theatre the other day, but we've got one better, I think, today. And we have got the executive producer and joint chief executive of the Mercury Theatre with us, and that is Tracy Childs. Hello, Tracy.
Hi, Tim. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you for joining me. I'm really looking forward to this. The Mercury Theatre, we know, has undergone or is undergoing the £11 million revamp. We talked a lot to Steve about this, but how have you been affected? What's your role been in the revamp?
So I have to say it has fallen very heavily on Steve's shoulders. He's the one who has been raising all the money and making sure we could actually afford to do this. And obviously with COVID, things have had to be a little bit delayed and therefore always become a little bit more expensive. So he's had to raise above and beyond and has done the most extraordinary job. The other person who has been so instrumental in this building is Nick Frampton, one of our employees who's been with us for decades now, I'm delighted to say. And as Steve always jokes, he raises the money and Nick spends it. And Nick's project managed this to within an inch of its life. It's just been brilliant. He's had eyes all over it and not missed anything. And then obviously we have been working with the builders, with Colchester Borough Homes, and it's been challenging, but actually so much easier than it could have been because the partners have been terrific. And basically, I've sat back and gone, oh no, I'd like this colour of bar, please. And, oh, are you sure? I'd like different chairs to that. And I think we do need this leather, actually. So it's been fabulous, me, because I've literally picked the colour of the auditorium seating, and there have been a few of us on the design team for the bar. You're never going to please all the people all the time. So I realise as I say that, there are going to be people coming up to me for years going, did you choose this? But, you know, we've been trying to make it feel like the most welcoming space in the world.
And it looks great. We're very fortunate to have a little tour the other day, and it's great, isn't it?
It's coming on really well.
And we're nearly there.
Nearly there. The furniture arrives next week, which is exciting and terrifying, because then you find out whether what you've ordered works together, works with the building, does look as welcoming as you think, does give everyone whatever they need. So, you know, be that some nice, low, comfortable chairs and sofas and things, but for those who have trouble getting out of those, some nice higher chairs and stools and comfortable eating spaces, comfortable drinking spaces, comfortable workstations. We're putting in a big table with plugs all down it so that you can just come and plug in and use our Wi-Fi and buy a coffee if you want. If you don't. This is Colchester's building.
Yeah.
You know, so if people don't like theatre, I want everyone to love theatre. But actually, if they don't, if they just want to come and shelter from the rain or use our Wi-Fi or have a wee, there are a lot more toilets.
Yes, and
we've doubled the amount of female toilets.
How instrumental were you in that?
Oh,
decision?
Very instrumental. That was
because the queues for the toilets in the old Mercury for women used to go round the block.
Oh, it was ridiculous. So we all knew that whatever else had to happen, we had to double the amount of toilets, which we managed to do. So, you know, we just want people to feel comfortable walking in through those doors and coming and enjoying it. Now, if they then pick up a brochure and think, oh, I didn't realise they did that here, I'd quite like to see that, then all the better. But actually, I want people to be first and foremost enjoying the building.
And there's surrounding areas where they can go outside and have a coffee or something to
Absolutely.
Eat.
Absolutely. We've got a whole outdoor seating area coming. There will be trees coming back outside. And at the moment, there's just a big concrete expanse, but there will be trees. And then all down the side along the Roman Wall, where all those beautiful trees are in existence anyway, we're having all of those fairy lit. And there will be, again, more seating around the base of the trees so people can enjoy that. And we'll have a cordoned off area where if they want to sit in that, then they buy drinks and food from us. But actually the other areas with all the seating around the trees, they can bring their own picnic, they can sit there and enjoy it. It's absolutely for Colchester's benefit.
It's so exciting. Really, really looking forward to it. Tracy, you're going to have one of the most modern state-of-the-art theatres in the country. That's a bit of a challenge for you and your job, in that we've got this great building now, we've got to do great shows. And part of that, I'm speaking to Ryan soon for a podcast, Ryan McBride, who's creative director, artistic director, and you and him will work hand in glove. Is that extra pressure on you? Because a brand new theatre with... with dressing rooms, 72, I think Steve said 72 dressing, or enough for 72.
For 72.
72 people.
I think 72 dressing rooms.
Would that would be a little over.
We only seat 530, but yes.
So do you think the fact that we're in this brand new state of the art modern theatre will attract productions and actors and to the area?
The obvious answer to that is I really, really hope so. And certainly we have already been able to obtain the rights to adapt a book that I'm not sure we would have been given previously.
Brilliant.
I can't tell you what it is yet, otherwise I'd have to kill you, but you know, we will find out soon. Exactly. It gives us lots of opportunities. This is the first time we've had a fully accessible building. So even though we cannot get wheelchair users down into the orchestra pit, what we can do is set up the orchestra in the dance studio and patch through.
Yeah.
So we can still have an MD or a conductor who is a wheelchair user with their full orchestra in the dance studio live, but transmitted via all of the wires and the screens and everything else.
Amazing.
So that the company on stage will still be able to see them and the audience will be able to hear them as if which gives us so many more opportunities. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. There are limiting factors. So one of the most limiting factors are the seat numbers, and I'm delighted we've got more seats in, but we haven't leapt up to 700 seats. We are still a mid-scale theatre, we have 530 now. And then on top of that, as you will know, Colchester is a beautiful old town, but the entrance and exit to this theatre are down narrow passageways.
They are.
So we can never have more than a 45-foot truck coming down there.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what limits the show. Because the big shows have five or six of those, or the big Pentecostals, and we just can't get them here.
Can't accommodate them. No.
So that is the real limiter on the show. Plus the amount of seats is obviously equates to the amount of money you can make in an evening.
Yeah.
And big shows are only going to come to us if they're going to make enough, A, to cover all of their running costs,
mm-hmm.
B, to help amortize their capitalization costs. And so if they've got a 10-week tour, whatever their capitalization of the show cost and their production costs, they need to divide that into 10 and earn that much as well each week.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they probably want to make a little bit of profit.
Yeah.
Plus, we need to be able to pay for our staffing costs and things. So the honest answer is, we won't suddenly be bringing Wicked the tour, I'm afraid. If anyone was thinking that,
or Les Mis,
it's not possible.
No.
But actually, we do get to work with some pretty classy theatre producers and companies. So
can't wait.
I'm hoping that you will all be thrilled by the new season that I'm putting to bed tomorrow.
Oh, excellent.
And handing over to marketing.
And when will we, the public, hear?
So that will go on sale the 27th of May.
Wow, fantastic.
And I'm hoping that there will be a bit of something for everyone. It feels like.
Yeah.
It. Because the other thing we have now, of course, is a studio.
Yes.
That becomes just a studio.
Program that as well.
Exactly. Before, it had to be a breakout space for the junior chorus on Panto. It had to be the creative education space 3 days a week. It had to be a meeting space, a higher space for people doing conferences. We have those spaces elsewhere in the building now. We have a dedicated creative learning space, which means also that when we're working, for instance, with our groups that have special educational needs, they will know absolutely that when they come to the Mercury, that's their room.
Mm-hmm.
And they can arrive and go to their room quite comfortably knowing that's their space. Whereas previously, we've been moving them around the building just to try and accommodate them. And that's really disorientating.
Yeah.
So those kind of things are brilliant. But it also means, with meeting rooms to hire, that the studio becomes a studio.
Yeah.
We also have a full rehearsal room and dance studio. So that means that we can program our studio as many nights as we want, which we will start gently, but eventually we're going to be open 6 days a week from Tuesday to Sunday.
Great.
And that studio will be programmed too. Fantastic. On top of that, we have the bar, which we can program, obviously with nothing too loud. Mm-hmm. We're not about to upset our neighbours. But we can do some stand-up in the bar. We can do maybe jazz on a Sunday lunchtime because we're going to have be operating a restaurant there. So there are so many opportunities, and we're really looking on the studio as the home of new writing.
Yeah.
And the place where we can put on some really edgy, interesting new work and nurture local artists, nurture new artists.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know, we've had a program that's been running, Mercury Playwrights.
Yes,
where
indeed.
We've been mentoring 14 playwrights. And the plays that have come out of that have been extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
So we are lining several of those up for production now. So there is this fantastic kind
so
of pipeline
exciting. So
where
exciting.
We start with mentoring, and then we get to the point where we're commissioning and then putting something on in the studio, and then hopefully helping those artists grow so that within the next 2 years they've got a main house show.
Sounds magnificent. It's so exciting for Colchester. I want to get into, and it's been really tough for the theatre industry.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of an organisation called Freelancers Make Theatres Work.
Yeah.
And I know you're, as an actress, freelancers, how would you describe freelancers making theatre work? Do you think people, the general public, understand about freelancers and how it works with theatre?
Maybe not. I mean, I was at the Mercury is my first full-time job. So I came here in 2014, and before that I had spent decades being an actor. And you can be living hand to mouth, you can have to adapt and do all kinds of other jobs. I was very lucky, most of the time I absolutely earned my living as an actor, but have had to do other jobs and know precisely what that's like. But have been doing those other jobs in a normal, in inverted commas, climate. And for theatre, so we at the Mercury, under normal circumstances, if we're fully open, if we have all of our front of house staff who are there to make the bars work and make people coffee and do all of that, then we go up to over 100 people in our staff.
So that's employed?
That's employed.
Okay.
But to make a show, 70% of the people making that show are freelance.
Yeah.
So we will have the production team, we will have our production manager, stage management team, construction team, so we've got our workshop building the set, our wardrobe making the costumes, our stage management team. But all of those actors, all of those designers, all of those musicians, everyone who comes and helps us create that world that we put in front of you, 70% of them are freelancers. And that means they don't know where their job is coming from until someone like the Mercury pick up a phone and say, are you free? Can you come and do this job with us? So when we did our pantomime in the tent, we had over 40 freelancers working on that. So for instance, when that was live streamed over Christmas, the money was split.
And oh, I see. I didn't know that.
Yes. So 50% of that money was divided between every single one of those freelancers, mm-hmm. not just the people on stage, not just the designers, everyone who held a spotlight or swept the stage or was helping the actors change. Every single one of them benefited.
That's brilliant.
Because they have had the toughest time imagined.
Yeah, because they haven't necessarily had the access to support that people on furlough have had.
No.
There's been some self-employed help, hasn't there?
There has, but there have been a lot of ways to drop through the cracks.
Yes.
So for instance, as I've just said, most actors have to do a second job.
Yeah.
If they've been doing a second job where they've been PAYE for more than 50% of the previous year, so they might have been working, for instance, as an usher in a theatre to help pay the bills for, say, 7, 8, 9 months of that year, and then they get the West End contract of their dreams,
mm-hmm.
and they drop the PAYE job. I say drop, obviously, you know, their employer will be thrilled for them. And they go and take that West End role. And 1, 2, 3 months in, COVID strikes. Well, they're not going to get anything. Because as far as the government is concerned, they had a PAYE yeah. job for more than 50% of the previous year, so they're not entitled. If you're a young graduate starting out and you don't have 3 years of tax records, there are so many ways you can drop through the cracks. And there are some people out there who've been in the business a long time who've told me that they're doing absolutely fine and the government has really looked after them and they've been incredibly grateful. And I have to say, the job retention scheme for us has done exactly what it said on the tin, and we've been able to get through this crisis without having to make any of our staff redundant.
That's amazing.
And that would not have been possible without the furlough scheme. So we are also incredibly grateful. But there are an awful lot of other people who have not been so lucky.
Yeah.
And actually, we've done everything we can. We set up a hardship fund so that anyone who could work with us in the last 2 years who was struggling, our staff as well as our freelancers, could apply. Because also for our staff, you know, they maybe have been used to having two incomes coming in, and suddenly if their partner has been made redundant or was a freelancer and has lost their job. So the hardship fund was anyone who'd been working with us for the last couple of years, and we've emptied it and topped it up again several times. It's been a really, really hard
time. Yeah. So I think if anything message comes out of this interview, it's that freelancers are really important to theatre. They couldn't
help. Incredibly important. We cannot make shows without them. They are our lifeblood, really. And also, very often, the second string for them is still connected with the hospitality industry.
Yeah.
So they either work as ushers or they work in restaurants or bars, all of which have also been closed.
Of course.
So they can't even go and do their second string.
No.
So, you know, a lot of people I know have been working in supermarkets and doing, you know, all of any job they can find. But everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah,
there
just
are
food on
jobs
the table.
Out there at the moment. Absolutely.
Yeah. Tracy, can I take you back?
How far back?
Right away. As a little girl growing up, when did you first decide you wanted to be an actor?
Age 5.
Age?
Yeah.
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 Good.
Yeah.
So school plays and all that. All that business.
Funny enough, apparently the first time I was looking at television adverts on ITV. And turn around to my mother and said, I'm going to do that. Yes, dear, of course you can. But yes, I then started doing school plays and loved them and went to a little dance and drama school.
Yeah.
And loved the shows we put on there.
Yeah.
So much so, I was lucky enough to have a teacher who thought that I was worth investing in and spoke to my parents and said she really ought to be auditioning for, you know, performing arts schools.
Yeah.
My parents were really against that, but because they wanted me to have a really good education. And in those days, they thought the two were mutually exclusive. So they thought, well, we'll let her apply for them. And then when she doesn't get in, because the competition's really high, she'll want to be an air hostess. And so they looked through it and they found a school that had the highest amount of applicants for the smaller, fewest amount of places, and thought, let's send her for an audition there. And hopefully she won't get in and she'll want to. I don't know why they wanted me to be an air hostess. I don't know. But of course I got in.
Yeah. Which one was that? Which school?
Elmhurst Ballet School.
Oh, okay.
And being the brilliant parents they were, they just went, well, then she needs the chance. Because actually, if the odds were against her, let's give her the opportunity. And
did they have a background in theatre or
not
showbiz at all?
No.
So
nothing, no one anywhere. No idea where that gene came from. Although I did quite often say when I was 4, you sure? I was quite young. You sure I wasn't adopted? but I went to Elmhurst when I was 11.
Yeah.
And I think 3 weeks after I started, they discouraged children from working because they were a bit snobby, if I'm honest. they used to only allow certain prestigious productions to come look at their girls. Anyway, one of those was Upstairs Downstairs.
Okay.
The original one.
Yeah.
Back in the day with Gordon Jackson and
John Waterson.
Absolutely. Pauline Collins.
Yeah.
That amazing cast. Yeah. Jean Marsh.
Yeah.
And so they had the whole school line up in the car park, and these three executives from upstairs, downstairs walked up and down the rows and stopped and talked to a few of us, and eventually went, you, London auditions next week. And the other two were 2 years older than me. And the three of us were taken up to London for an audition.
Wow.
And in those days, I was a titch. I was really small. I'm quite tall now, but I was very small in those days. And the part was to play Hannah Gordon's daughter, and you had to be taller than Hannah Gordon. And I wasn't.
Oh, dear.
So I did this audition with them. And when I walked into the room, there were 12 people behind a desk. I'm 11 years old. And I wasn't fazed at all, as far as I was concerned. This was absolutely where I was meant to be. And the director was sitting there with his arm in a sling, and he was one of the people I'd met at the school in the car park. And I said, "What's happened to your arm?" And he told me a story about falling off a horse. And I howled with laughter and thought that was really funny, not bothered at all. And they said, "Do you want to do that?" I said, "I love acting. It's all I've ever wanted to do." Anyway, one of the other girls got the part. And then a week later, my mother got a phone call saying we'd like to write a little part in for her if she wants to do this. I mean, this is like your dream, isn't it? It's like falling off a bloody log. Sorry to swear. But actually, you know, it was so easy.
Wow.
And it got easier than that because I went and did this little 2 minutes, literally 2 minutes on upstairs, downstairs. The best week of my life. They paid me £42, which in 1974 was a lot of money. Gordon Jackson, I walked into this, I watched the show on the Sunday night with all that cut glass and silver and
Amazing. Beautiful
silks and costumes. And I walked into the Duke of York's barracks, which of course now a really swanky block of flats, but it was a really old tatty barracks. And they were rehearsing on horrible old trestle tables with paper plates and plastic cutlery. And I was so disappointed. And then Gordon Jackson walked the length of the room to come and introduce himself.
Oh, bless him.
And took my hand and took me all the way around and introduced me to everyone. He was such a gentleman. He was just beautiful.
Old school, yeah.
Human being. And I had this great week rehearsing and then performing. And the director had got in an agent. I made them stand on the floor in the corner and said, "Just have a look. We think she might be worthwhile." And the agent asked if I wanted to join, and that was me. Started as an actor. Now, really, it got tougher later.
Yes.
But it was like falling off a log, getting started. I was so lucky, and what a beautiful start. Really.
So did you then go on to another drama school?
No, I stayed at Elmhurst and I worked all the way through. The only, the last two terms were the only terms that I was there permanently because they wouldn't let me work while I was doing my A-levels.
Okay.
Otherwise, I was off doing jobs the entire time, and we used to play this ridiculous game because, as I said, they were quite snobby about letting their girls work. So I'd go and get a job and say, my parents would say, "Oh, she's going to be away to do, you know, such and such filming." And they'd go, no, we're not going to allow that. And so my mother would go, "Oh, okay, so she'll have to leave the school then. Oh, well, okay, she can just do this one job then." And we do this every term. And some of them involved me going to Scotland for months to do the primary Miss Jean Brodie, kind of barely being at school in a year and having tutors up there. So I buckled down my last two terms to do my O-levels. And I left Elmhurst at 16 and was planning to go to, I was doing private lessons at the Guildhall.
Yeah.
And was planning to do drama school properly, but I was working as I was bridging the gap. And by the time, working as an actor, and by the time I got to 18 and was old enough to go to drama school, I was offered the lead in a huge series. And I said to them, "What do I do?" And they said, "Good, take a series, really, learn on the job, don't, you know, just get on with it." So I never ever did drama school properly. And I think felt a slight fraud because of it, to be honest.
Really?
Yes. I think it also made me very safe as an actor. So upstairs, downstairs was a joy of a job, but I have a very mobile face. Sorry, this is, you know,
good
sound,
for radio.
So you're
yeah.
just having to imagine
good
this.
For podcast.
But, you know, basically this face was made for fast from the back of an auditorium. So on television, it was that scene that I did was way over the top. And I'm amazed I actually got an agent from it. it took a lot of work for me to tone that down. And I think I became very safe because I had never had that drama school experience of being amongst your peers. And part of the point is being able to fail and fail safely.
Ah, yeah.
So my first mistake went out to 42 million people.
Yeah, I remember, because was that three channels in those days?
Yeah, and also, of course, it went worldwide.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So, massive international hit, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I still get checks for, you know, 3p from Nicaragua or something. It is extraordinary.
It is.
It literally went everywhere. So I think I became very timid as an actor, and it was not until I was, I think, in my 30s, until I kind of went, oh, hang on. Okay, maybe I sort of know how to do this now. Let's lose the straitjacket. Let's enjoy this.
Okay, well let's name check some of it. Howard's Way, of course.
Of course.
Sense and Sensibility, Born and Bred, Hollyoaks, Broadchurch. I didn't know you were in Broadchurch.
Ah, yes. Well, the person who wrote Broadchurch wrote Born and Bred.
Ah.
So I played David Tennant and Olivia Colman's boss.
Isn't that the guy who now writes Doctor Who?
Yes, Chris Chibnall. Amazing writer.
Yeah.
Gorgeous writer.
Yeah.
Lovely man. Yes.
Bergerac?
Yes.
We loved Bergerac. Didn't everybody love Bergerac? And Doctors?
Oh, yes. I did. Actually, I did Doctors several times because I first of all did it as a guest.
Yeah.
And then I went and did it as a semi-regular.
Oh, okay.
So I went and played one of the regular's moms.
Yeah. So what a career.
I had fun. I had a lot of fun.
So what are the highlights?
Okay, in terms of roles,
then
for me it's always theatre, always
yes.
theatre.
Yes.
So for the roles, the first one will be Tracy Lord in High Society. I can't sing a friggin' note. How I got away with it, I have no idea, but that role was mine, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are we talking about? We're talking about a really tightly conforming ice maiden who turns into a complete sex maniac when she has a drink. God, am I really identifying with this woman? But yes, it was such a joy to play. I loved that role.
Yeah.
And then obviously Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is the dream role, full stop. It is the most perfect play. I used to stand there, Matthew Kelly was playing George, and I used to stand there backstage thinking, I'm very neatly dressed, and how do I get to the end of this play as a complete wreck on the floor, ripped and torn, and you know, literally every vein open. I haven't got time to think about that. Just go out there. And Edward Albee had just built the steps. So you just start the play, and emotionally he just builds it. So it is the most beautiful experience as an actor. And my heavens, it got all the angst out of me. I was so nice to be around when I was playing Martha, because she's a cow. Yeah. So I get angst out on stage and come off and feel really, really good.
What about Lady M? You ever done Lady M?
No, I really wanted to play Lady M. And funny enough, when I took the job at the Mercury, the show that was opening was the Scottish play. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. Am I actually going to be standing at the back of the auditorium wishing I was on stage? And you know, I wasn't, not for a moment. I found it really interesting because I loved acting. I absolutely adored it. As I said,
at
the age of five, I decided I wanted to do it almost before I knew what it was.
Yes.
Had this amazing time. Didn't have the career I necessarily would have chosen.
No.
Because bizarrely, I'd have chosen to have been at the RSC and the National and doing all those big classical roles. But wow, did I have an amazing time and work with some amazing people from, you know, Laurence Olivier and Anthony Hopkins and Gary Oldman.
Wow.
You know, just extraordinary people. Earned some money, earned a living. I mean, I just had the best time. Didn't imagine I would ever, ever want to do anything else.
So when did you decide?
I didn't.
To get into production?
I didn't, not for a second. I became an accidental producer.
Oh, okay.
So we did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then we were offered a transfer to Trafalgar Studios in London.
Oh, yeah.
And no one was available to take it in. And the director, Andrew Hall, the late, great, gorgeous Andrew Hall, my darling friend of about a decade by then, was directing the show and said to me, no one's available, no one will, it's too short a time span because, you know, it's now November and the play is in May. the slot, no one will take it in. And I said, fine, you and me, 50-50, risk and reward, what do you reckon? And he went, yes, let's do it. So I was producing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf so that I could get better roles as an actor. Mm-hmm. He was doing it so he'd get better plays to direct. That didn't happen to either of us. But what happened was we had this amazing experience of being proactive for once and actually picking up phones and making things happen. The thing that always drove me mad as an actor was being passive, waiting for someone to give me a role. I loathed it. And there's a real danger that if you kind of push too much, or, you know, people think you're just a bit pushy and you shouldn't, they don't want to employ you. So it's a really difficult balance to get right. And just sitting there waiting for my agent to ring was to drive me insane. Whereas suddenly I was ringing up and giving other people work and making things happen. And it felt fantastic. And Virginia Woolf taught me that I couldn't do both at the same time, because I literally would go from that moment I've just been talking about with Matthew, about I'm all neat and tidy, I'd go out, I'd do the first four lines, and by then I'd counted the house. And literally, I would be able to look and go, there are two seats empty over there, we were sold out tonight. Have they paid for their tickets? Not turned up, or have those seats gone? Because if they haven't paid for tickets, I don't pray! And you go, oh, okay, focus, Tracy, focus, this is quite a big role. So I learned very quickly that, you know, I was, the show was so popular, it sold out in 24 hours because we got such amazing reviews. I mean, reviews I wouldn't have dared write for myself. But actually, it didn't lead to any other roles for me as an actor because, A, it sold out so quickly, I don't think the industry were necessarily getting in to see it. But I think in a sense that was a gift because Andrew and I discovered that we loved producing. So therefore, we actually started on a whole new career and set up a producing company and went out touring shows. The first tour of which was a co-production with the Mercury Theatre in Colchester.
Weird. Can we pause there for a minute? Because I want to do the my favourite things, which I did forewarn you about. I haven't told you what.
Not what.
And so we'll do that. And then we'll come back to Colchester and how you got here and all that. And why Colchester is what it is. But we'll do this fun favourite things. So I'll just ask you 10 things. And then I throw in one at the end that might be a bit off the wall. Okay. Favourite play?
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Edward Albee.
Book?
I'm going to go traditional. I'm going to go with Tale of Two Cities with Charles Dickens because I read it when I was 12 and it was the best one that I'd ever read and it gave me a love of reading that's never gone away.
Brilliant. Film?
Amadeus. You can tell I love theatre, can't you?
Yes. TV show? Can be one that you're in.
It could be one I'm in, couldn't it? But actually, I'm going to choose The West Wing. Sorry, I have to have this.
I keep people keep telling me I've got to watch The West Wing. I've only ever watched one episode.
Oh, no,
and
you
as a
really
politician, yeah.
Starting from the beginning.
Yeah. I've only ever watched the first episode. So we'll get the box set. Song. Favourite song?
The Shadow of Your Smile. I Walk Down the Aisle to It.
Oh, really? Oh, lovely. Meal. Favourite meal?
Oh, that's the one I'm not going to be able to choose because I love food.
What's the first thing that's come into your head?
No, everything. I can't imagine. I love food.
Well, today, now, what would you want now?
Can I choose six courses?
No, just one.
Oh, for goodness sake. It'll be any kind of pasta dish.
Okay.
But really, food. I love food.
Favourite sport?
Interesting. To watch, my favourite sport would be tennis.
Oh, lovely.
I'm not a sports person. I don't play sports at all. I swim. I run a bit.
But you like watching tennis.
But I love watching tennis.
Good. Holiday destination?
Of all the exotic places in the world, funny enough, I have a weird history with the Isle of Wight and love it. Happy place.
Never been.
So I've been about 8 times without ever seeing it in daylight, which is, or beyond the ferry, which is a bizarre story. Literally filming, getting off the ferry, turning around, going on the ferry back, being taken as a child, not remembering it, doing a show there in the evening, arriving in the dark, leaving at 6 in the morning for the ferry back. I literally had gone 9-10 times, never seen it. 2 years ago, said to my husband, I really think we need to go, and just been addicted to the place that serves.
Right, interesting.
My second favourite place would be Lake Bled.
Oh, I've never been to it either. So, gorgeous, got to check those out. This is the one that's catching people out. Favourite famous person with the name Tracy?
Ooh, I'm not going to go Tracy Emin. I'm not going to go for the tennis player. Who am I going to go for? I might have to, because I now have to think. Tracy is not an easy one, is it?
Well, I was discussing this with...
Spencer Tracy, am I allowed to go that way?
Yes, of course you are, because Ben Howard did that with Tony Benn.
Yeah, lovely. I have Spencer Tracy, thank you very much.
Favourite cartoon character?
Especially if Catherine Hepburn's with him.
Favourite cartoon character?
Betty Boop.
Oh, of course. And
actually, can I go for Jessica Rabbit?
You can go for Jessica
Rabbit. When I played Tracy Lord in High Society...
There's another Tracy.
Exactly. They said to me, what kind of evening dress do you want? And I said, I want to look like Jessica Rabbit. Yeah.
Excellent. And the one I'm going to throw in at the end, favourite hairstyle?
Anything that's not this, which is 5.5 months
lockdown
of no
hair.
Hairdressers. Oh,
what's been your favourite hairstyle over your life? Because I had a mullet once and I loved it but that was the 80s.
Like bobs and things, I suppose. I have had everything from exceedingly long hair that had really nothing to literally shaving my head with a number two before I went to the Himalayas. And everything in between. I probably loved having a bob when I was in my 30s and had very glamorous thick hair.
Great. Thank you for that, Tracy. That's a lovely diversion. But let's get back to the final part of the podcast interview, and that is how you got to Colchester, how the Made in Colchester program and all that, which has been brilliant, and why you think Colchester is this place that attracts culture and people like you here. How does that all happen? So if you can, that's given you a whole panoply of stuff to think
about.
Well,
let me give you my whole history with Colchester first, which started when I moved to Essex in 2004 for love. I actually live about an hour away, but one of the first things I did when we moved to Essex was say to my to-be husband, I think we need to go and check out Mercury Theatre in Colchester. It's great rep, it's got very good reputation. And I think the first show I saw here was Twelfth Night, with Ignatius Antony playing, he was playing Orsino, but actually, anyway, with a gorgeous cast, with Christine, with everybody was in it that we know and love. And I became a sort of semi-regular. And then, as I say, when I was producing my first tour, we did a co-production with the Mercury. So we brought Haunting Julia here, and they were our starting house. And I just had the best time here working with the team and getting the show up and running here and loving the theatre, loving the space, loving the staff. Because actually, buildings are great, but it's always about the people who are in them. And we're so blessed in the staff we have here. They're just amazing. And there was a great staff then, some of whom are still with us, which is brilliant. So I had a really good, really positive experience. And then Daniel Buckroyd was just taking over at that point. So he hadn't been in place when I'd done the deal, but he was in place to come to the first read-through. And a little while later, maybe 6 months to a year later, did that fantastic headhunter's trick of sending me a link and going, we're recruiting for board members. Would you like to circle this amongst your contacts, please? And I read it and went, well, I live in Essex and I love Colchester and I care about the theatre. Can I apply? I so hoped you'd say that. I became a board member.
All right.
And I joined the board in 2013. And then one board meeting, they started talking about how they decided they needed a producer. And I went very quiet. And so at the end of the meeting, I sidled up to the chair of the board and went, I don't know the etiquette for this, but she said, it's fine. You just have to resign. Okay. Quite a bold step.
Yes.
So I applied to be their full-time producer and got the role. It was at a time when Andrew and I had just had a tour that had not gone so well financially, critically, and you know, we'd got 5 stars across the board and everyone had seen the show and loved it. We'd taken out kinder transport, but it had just emptied the audiences, unfortunately. And so we hadn't got the money to put the next show on. And he'd just been offered a semi-regular slot in Coronation Street. So we both had a kind of deal that we'd go away and do other things and meet back again at a later time. And sadly, he never lived long enough for us to do that. But I therefore kind of felt free for the first time in my life, knowing that actually I wanted to produce and not act, to take a full-time job. And I came here in 2014, Macbeth being the first show, and then I was their producer up until Daniel left in 2018, when I stepped up to executive producer and joint chief exec. And I have been having a ball. I love this theatre, I love the people, I love this town. I think we have...
Yeah, why is that? What is it about Colchester?
I think it's a real mixture of its history, of the vibrancy of its people, the vibrancy of its art scene. I love that you have the Art Centre sitting next to the Mercury, sitting next to First Sight. You know, there is just a real buzz here, and music and comedy and drama, and we've all got our own kind of vibe. But the people are always so friendly. It's a very big town, but a very small village in another way. It has a real heart. You can't go anywhere without bumping into people you know, without people smiling at you and talking to you and being friendly. I mean,
in my case, shouting at me most of the time.
Well, that's what goes with your job. I'm delighted to say, mostly I get people saying, "Oh, I love that show." So, you know, most of the time I get a better class of person choice, a better class of comment. That's better. The people are lovely. It's the comments that change.
They are.
So it's got a real heart to it, I think. And I have loved putting on shows here and seeing, you know, we do everything from ABBA tribute bands to Greek tragedy and everything in between. And we get to meet so many different people who have so many different connections to Colchester and do so many different jobs or volunteer in so many different places and ways. And I sit at the back of the auditorium sometimes and it feels like a little bit of all of Colchester coming together, and I love that. I just love it. So it's a really, you know, we're doing a lot of recruitment at the moment, mm-hmm. and part of the pack is, you know, this is what you get if you move to Colchester, and you get the park, and you get the castle, and you get, you know, it's got everything.
It really is.
It's got really quick connections to London.
Yeah.
When they work. You know, so if you need to be in a major city, you can be in 50 minutes, mm-hmm. but actually you've got stunning countryside, you've mm-hmm. got lots of culture, you've got lots of art, lots of history, wonderful property. For those of us who come from London, reasonable property, reasonably priced property, you know. So the recruitment packs look fantastic. I'm sorry, we've got people jumping up and down above our heads. If you're hearing bangs, the building is still being built.
Thank you, Tracy. That's been incredibly wonderful, and I've learned so much. And it's been great, and we look forward to seeing the shows in the new theatre very soon. Thank you for joining me. Join me again soon for another edition of the Cultural Colchester podcast.